Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Shudder, the premium streaming video service devoted to horror, thrillers, and suspense. Backed by AMC Networks, Shudder has a growing and dynamic selection of thrilling premieres, originals, and exclusives, including pregnancy horror comedy Prevenge, The Ring vs. The Grudge franchise mashup Sadako vs. Kayako, and We Are the Flesh. This week's Shudder highlight is George Scott, a 10-episode folk horror series declared by Dread Central the kind of mystery show you wish were made more often. When Eva, a policewoman, returns to her hometown several years after her daughter's disappearance, she quickly begins investigating a new wave of vanishing children. As her search draws her deep into the forest, she realizes there are supernatural secrets in the town, and if she exposes them, it could make someone or something very angry. Stream the series called A Borgian and Stranger Things Mashup by the Toronto Star now exclusively on Shudder. Shudder is available for the web, iOS, Android, Chromecast, Apple TV, and Roku for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership. But Shockwaves listeners get a free month by entering the promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of horror available to stream anywhere.
Guys, so much for coming
Thank
to these
you
so live
much.
Shockwaves.
This is a good crowd, guys.
Yeah, this is amazing.
Good crowd.
Oh, look at this. You have an outline.
I do have an outline because I'm prepared.
I have pages
Ulrich
of notes.
And I never prepare.
We're getting transparency into the Shockwaves process.
Yeah, Ryan and I are What's like this? Meticulous notes and they just kind of show up. And
yeah,
look at their
I just realized without notes that I'm just lost and I'm rambling.
Quit copying off me.
I'm not copying.
You're copying off me.
All right.
You have nothing.
Welcome to
want.
Episode 50. This is the 50th episode of Shockwaves.
One year.
The birthday was last week, I believe. And also, shout out to the dude who's cosplaying as our logo.
Oh, can he come up?
Can you please stand up?
Come up here for a minute so we can take a
really,
picture.
It's genius.
And Rob, stand up so they can see the shirt.
Yeah.
Look at this. The shirt so design.
Comes alive.
And
the shirt comes alive. This is so awesome.
Does this seem long?
Vincent. This is amazing.
Vincent!
You rock, man. Thank you so much. Oh. Let's
Here
do
we
it.
Go.
Let's do this.
Your lip for us.
So our listeners are getting a full photograph experience.
We're taking a picture on air.
Awesome.
All right.
Our listeners are home like, what are they doing?
What are they
this
doing?
Is so boring
it's
already.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Every time they experiment, it sucks. you guys having a good Texas Frightmare experience?
No.
What's your favorite panel so far? The Thing?
I thought Bates Motel was pretty spectacular,
Bates
Ryan.
Bates Motel?
Udo Kier gave me a back rub Fright this Night? Morning.
Friday 5.
Friday 5.
Yay!
Seriously, I was doing the Puppet Master panel and Udo Kier
Yeah,
Kier
as an objective
me,
listener, the Puppet Master was pretty spectacular.
Well, thank you.
Udo was in
Getting
top
handsy.
Form.
He was, yeah, he was a live wire, including the frequent rubbing of my shoulders and back during
it was also
the panel.
The really
a little distracting.
The really amazing thing about the Puppet Master panel was so they're talking about the reboot or this new Puppet Master, which looks very fun. And Udo is sort of talking like, we made this new Puppet Master and there was only one. And then I never realized that there were 2, 3, 4, 5. They were all made just for money. And Charles Band's just sitting right over here. And somehow Charles Band, of all people, is balking at the idea that he did something just for money. He's like, what? I'm like, that's literally what you're known for.
But then he called Udo out on it later, and he was like, apparently I just did them for money. Like,
and
it
like,
worked somehow.
I'm like, bud, no one's
Go
mad
Charlie.
At you. We just know you're like a top-level huckster.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah,
well, he's reselling the fucking, that box set, the Empire box set that's like got DVD Blu-rays. That Yeah, it is.
It's
I want it.
$150.
But it's got stuff that's already exists
like
on from Screen Factory.
Like a champion making
money. Hey, by the way, we've got Sam Zimmerman in the house.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sam from Shudder. Shudder subscribers out there, let's see. Show of hands.
Awesome.
There we
Thank
go.
You.
This
Look
is
at
so
that.
Red.
Love
you.
It. This is great.
You all get a year free for
it.
Coming to this podcast. You just have
what?
To hashtag SamZ. Guaranteed.
I did not say that.
All right. So do we want to dive right in with our topic?
Do we introduce ourselves?
Do you guys
know
who we are?
Does anybody have no idea what Shockwaves is?
Yeah, has anybody never heard of Shockwaves before?
Oh, this guy.
Yeah. This guy. This guy.
He thought it was a Ken Wiederhorn panel.
Show hands.
Worst day of his life. Sorry, man.
He's like, I thought we were celebrating the original Nazi zombies.
The original Nazi zombies.
Well, Rebecca, why don't you explain what Shockwaves is?
So we are a podcast. It originally started as Killer POV 3 years ago with Geek Nation. And it was, how many?
Four now.
Well, 3 years with Geek Nation, one more with Blumhouse. So my math is flawless, guys.
Yep. All
right. So, and that one was with Rob Elric and I. And at the same time, Ryan had another show on the same network, Geek Nation.
Yep, called The Bloodcast. And I did it, I took over from somebody else, and they didn't really walk me through how to do a podcast. So I was on my own for a little while. So I did about 10 episodes by myself, just interviewing people. And then I did one episode solely by myself, just talking into empty space. So that was a fun experimental episode. And then I brought on Clark Wolf, who used to write for Collider and Nerdist, and now she's part of Collider Nightmares, the YouTube show. And we did, I think, about 25 episodes together. And then I left for Blumhouse. I went to go take a job at Blumhouse. And then along the way, there was internal talk about, once we got Blumhouse.com going, it was like, well, let's get a podcast going. And I was like, well, look, guys, there's a great podcast out there called Killer POV. We should just bring the gang over and give them the free reign to do whatever they want. So this podcast was born. And they recorded regularly across the hall from my office. So I got really jealous hearing them at the end of the night recording their podcast and laughing. I was kind of like the kid on the outside of the playground watching all the kids
hang
from the monkey.
You'd be like, okay, guys, I'm going to start now.
And also, when I listen too, and so when I'd be driving to work, I'd hear like, Elric,
Fright Night 2 is better than Fright Night 1. Am I right?
This fucking bullshit about Fright Night 2.
It's
and
a dangerous
I'm just
room
like
for that.
Yelling at myself in LA traffic, going, fuck you, Elric, fuck you.
We all feel
that.
If
I was only on Shockwaves.
Sam's got my back, right, Sam?
Well, at least you're able to do that because I know all of you and I live in New York. So most of the time it's like I'm just on my way to work, like trying to interject and tell you're all a bunch of idiots.
From the East Coast.
I've never had a podcast. Because I'm only good at guest spots. So.
But Sam and I go way back to like our Fangoria days. Like Sam and I have been in the trenches together for literally like over a decade now. So
yeah,
we go way back. And that was, we both started out at Fangoria and then I went to Blumhouse and Sam went to Shutter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah. Now we're as Elric likes to call it, a well-oiled Voltron.
Yes.
That loves to tackle horror. And if any of us fall out for an episode, the episodes are not as strong because we really need to lock together to form this.
Whoever's missing, somebody will tweet us going, that person was the engine of your show. Your show sucks without them. Yeah. Every one of us has had
every
that
every one of us has that.
And it's
like
nice for a moment, but fuck that. Yeah. We do our best.
Yeah. So that's Shockwaves.
Yes.
And, you know, we've tried a different, you know, originally it was going to be like, it was like a first segment, just talking about movies. Second segment, second half of the show being an interview. And then we tried a bunch of different formats, and we were trying to figure it out. We did two episodes a week instead of one. And then we were like, no, fuck that. We're going to do one episode a week and really throw our all into a nice two-hour podcast. And then sometimes we do just, you know, retrospective things. We just look back at, we'll just find a topic that we just want to riff on, and we won't have a guest at all. But you guys and the feedback you give us inform us about how the show should go sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes we find that you guys don't like the interview segments and you just like to hear us ramble.
Why?
But then we get complaints about, oh, this is just like four people who talk about themselves.
That was one guy.
Do you like living?
Do you like living?
What does that even mean?
Yeah.
Anyway,
that joke might be too specific.
No. There was a Facebook comment thread that was going on. Somebody didn't particularly care for us talking about our experiences in horror.
Who has never listened to a podcast before.
Yeah, never listened to a podcast. And then someone came in and chimed in and defended us, and this guy responded, do you like living? We're like, oh, shit.
It was way extra.
We're not going to say who it is, but since then he's written on us four emails asking if he could come on the show. So, you know, who's laughing now?
All insulting, too.
Yeah.
You guys are terrible, but I'll come on if you still want to have me.
Yeah. So thanks for having us back, because these guys did, you guys did Killer POV here.
A couple years ago. We did it twice. Yeah.
Yeah. Two years in a row we did.
And did anyone come to any of the previous things we did here?
DJ Big Red was there.
We brought AJ Bowen one time.
Yeah. And of course Dustin was there. Yeah. So, yeah.
So what are we talking about today, Ryan? We're going to give you a taste of the show.
Because
obviously we're not going to do an interview, and we don't have 2 hours to do that. But we wanted to riff on a topic, and make it fun and feel interactive.
Yeah, this episode's called "Overlooked and Unloved Films of the '90s."
Yeah,
and this all came about because we, you know, like I was telling somebody else, one of these days we're just going to publish our text chain because it's pretty insane. Sometimes it's just us arguing over one another, trying to figure out like the theme of the show. And we
texted all hours of night. Like
all hours in the night.
Like 12:30.
2:30 in the morning.
Night,
it's like Becca just going,
from
hey.
These guys. Yeah. Hey, guys, I just watched blank. Here's what I thought about it. And it's continuous.
And then there will come a mysterious text from me that says, can't we do this via email?
Or hey, guys, it's Sunday.
It's Sunday.
And that is an actual text because I'm like, it's fucking Sunday,
and
guys.
Then we'll
horror doesn't stop for weekends.
But then we stopped texting Rob for about 12 hours, but then we start back up really
quickly. Yeah. We took it. We went to another chain.
Yeah, we'll start another chain and then we come back.
The 90s we landed on just simply because the 80s are so, I mean, like, when you talk about overlooked and unloved films, I just felt like if we dove into the 80s, I'd be like,
there's like no more from the
80s. Yeah.
I feel like there's overlooked.
Terrorvision. Everybody like, yeah, I fucking love Terrorvision. Yeah. It's like, oh, okay, great. So what about the 90s? Because, go ahead.
Plus the 90s, they get a bad rap. Like everybody, you know, you look at, I've heard the 80s called the silver age of horror so many times. You know, if we say that the golden age was like all of the Universal monsters of the 30s, that silver age was the 80s, because that's when we had Freddy and Mike Myers and Jason and all these other major icons pop out. And then we go to the 90s, and everybody has talked about how there was this giant lull in horror.
Yeah. And I think that's a generational thing. Because I think it's a generational thing because there's a lot of younger horror fans who look upon the 90s very fondly because it gave them the post-scream slasher boom, you know? It gave them In the Mouth of Madness. It gave them Candyman, Jacob's Ladder, Event Horizon. You know, Event Horizon is an amazing
but
film.
It gave us Brain Scan.
And it also tried to kill off a lot of the old guard, you know. It tried to kill off Freddy and Jason. Leatherface just did whatever Leatherface does. And they still can't figure that out. But
I think that a lot of these films didn't get discovered and appreciated until a little bit after their time. Because even if we talk about Event Horizon, total bomb. I mean, it was completely unappreciated when it came out. They didn't even market it as a horror film. They marketed it as a sci-fi film because I went to see that thing with my mom, and then the flashback scene happens, and mom's like, is that man eating himself? And I'm
What else have you seen with your mom? I could have this discussion,
mom.
Too. What else have you seen with your mom that's, like, kind of weird?
Oh, my God. I my mom loves horror films, so she's seen all of the Blumhouse, canon.
Yeah.
So
yeah, but that's not weird, though. We make kind of just non-
She likes Phantoms.
But to play devil's
that's fucking weird.
I want to play devil's advocate here for a second because the 90s are bit shit. you just listed all the movies that are actually good from this period. And I was looking through it. There's some I love, but also that they're so chastised. Like we were just in here a few minutes ago talking about Friday Five, which is outrageous. The sex scenes are incredible. The death scenes are incredible. And still not, you know, it's not a great film by any chance. Some people love it. Some people hate it. But
it's a bit shit, Elric.
Yeah, but look at I Know What You Did. No, but look at I Know What You Did Last Summer and all these movies.
I Know What You Did Last Summer is fucking awesome.
No, yeah. Oh, no, they're so
it
chased.
Is awesome.
Oh, no. All right, listen. I Know You Did Last Summer. Chase. Not great, but The Chase is a legit chase. Great, sure. Great scene. Yeah. But
I think that a lot of it was also reflecting kind of the culture of the time, because if you think about like the 90s in general, we were all very resentful. We all hated everything.
We all wanted to
Everyone
be
was
queen.
A narc, and we hated everybody.
We
and
were a bit
it.
Shit. We are the problem. No, everything was a bit shit in the 90s. I'm sorry.
I'm going to go read liner notes
the thing
to
she
Melancholy
wins
and the Infinite Sadness.
And I Know What You Did Last Summer.
She gets like the Sarah Michelle Gellar gets like the Miss.
It's like the Miss Town or whatever.
Miss Town. Miss Fisherman
Townie.
Thing.
I want to be Miss Town.
But no, look, the 90s gave us a glut of horror films because of the direct-to-video market. Yeah. You know,
and
there was
a lot of
stuff
in there.
I am going to argue. So I always hear from fans and see, we even have an article on the Blumhouse website about 1986 being the greatest year of horror, just because there was so much coming out during that time. I could make a defense for 1999, which I will later in this podcast. But there was a ton of horror films that came out in 1999 that when I was actually researching this, I was like, wow, that was a really good year. Now, some of them didn't hit till later.
Yeah, that's because the 90s decided to, like, get good.
Yeah, right at the end, they were like, we should do something,
we're
guys.
Like, oh, we need to wrap up this decade. Yeah, it was also, I mean, like, I think just personally for me, it's kind of when I came online as a horror fan. You know, like, the 80s, I just kind of had to go with what my folks introduced me to. Like, I wasn't able to get out and go. I mean, like, the rules were a little loose, fast and loose in terms of what I was able to see and what not to see. But it wasn't until the 90s when I finally cut loose from home, cut loose from high school, moved to college, you know, moved to New York City, and then just started getting everything from Kim's Video. You know, that's when I got to see a lot of the nasty stuff. But then I was also a little bit more aware of what was coming out in the 90s. So it was just like, it's an interesting time. And when I look back at it, I'm like, yeah, it wasn't really all that bad. Mm. There's some good stuff. And I have a list of things that I would love to talk about. And you guys too. Hopefully, Rob, you have some stuff.
I've just decided on the three.
Oh, sure.
Because I don't read the text chain, so swinging it.
So we've been talking about this for
days. That well-oiled machine that we talked about. So, anyways, yeah, there was the 90s. Let's get into it, Elric.
What was the assignment?
Huh?
The
assignment was to pick three films each that we consider overlooked and unloved. So, hopefully, we'll be able to give you a few films that maybe you've never heard about, mm-hmm. or we'll be able to lend some new insight or perspective on films that you ordinarily thought were shit. So
a bit shit. I said I didn't go all the way with shit. I said a bit shit.
A bit shit.
And
it's just
a bit. Bitches. All right. Okay, only one film made me go to university and study criminology, and that was Eric Red's Body Bags. True story.
No, body parts.
Body parts. Sorry, not body bags. My bad. I'm one beer in. You know? I'm such a lightweight now. Body parts. Which is actually true. It's the only film. I watched this film at about 14, 15, and I literally decided in that moment, oh, I want to be a criminal psychologist. Because look at how interesting his life is. He has limbs from a serial killer attached to his body, but he maintains his job. He plays basketball. There's something about this movie. He takes in fine art, and he still drinks at a bar. There's something about this movie that really spoke to me at a certain age. Since meeting Eric Red, I kind of maybe cooled on the movie a little. He's a strange character. Great writer, though, and he is dark. Like his films, the one thing they all have, The Hitcher, you guys, Near Dark, these are some of the films he's written. This film is, for who's not heard of this movie? It's not Body Bags. It's Body Parts.
Okay. I've never
body parts
seen it.
From 1991.
Yeah. Okay, so it's basically a criminal psychologist gets in a bad car accident where he loses his arm, and they give him the arm of a serial killer, and he slowly finds out, he doesn't realize it's a serial killer's arm. Through the process of the movie, he starts to figure out that different limbs have been given to different people, and they all have these weird kind of reflexes coming back. So one happens to be playing basketball, but his legs kind of spaz out because they're serial killer legs. And that's what they do. It's super weird. I can't remember. No one has
Brad,
the head.
It's Brad. No.
Brad Dourif is the
artist.
Brad
Dourif has the other arm because he's a painter, so he's like painting the darkest, weirdest shit. And then the head is somewhere else.
Towards the end of the movie, you get a great reveal where the head's still around. So and there's a scene in this movie where the original head and all sorts of kind of weird part of his body is trying to get his parts back, and he chains the. Should I go there? Should I give you?
No. So
I'll leave you hanging.
Yeah. No. You don't have to leave it hanging. Body Parts is actually on my list too, and I'll adjust to add. But it's number one on my list. But what's interesting is that. Voltron. Body Parts spends the first hour of the movie dealing with the paranoia of what's his name? Jeff Fahey.
Jeff Fahey. It's his best role.
And it's really just about him coping with his family, coping with this body part that is acting spasmodic, and then talking to the other people who have these other body parts. And it's not until the final act of the film that someone starts to retrieve these body parts. So it starts to become in like an action horror movie.
It's like a PTSD trauma film. Like it could be real griefy, but it delivers. It gives you that. And this is something that I think is a bit of a holdover from the 80s is the fantastic is still in this movie. Yeah. And the further we go into the 90s, the more we lose that. When we get to Scream, post-Scream, I think that's what I'm talking about when I say it's a bit shit. It's like I feel like a little imagination's been lost in that period of filmmaking. Yeah. And it becomes a lot more about the kind of referential, which is fun, but...
Well, there's something Hitchcockian about the movie, you know. It's more of a quiet thriller than it is a horror film, more of a psychological thriller. And it's not until, and it feels like a big studio note where they were like, this is too boring. Can you just throw in a dude collecting his body parts again? Because there's some big moments, you know, at the very end. Especially with Brad Dourif, there's a moment when the guy reclaims his arm. It just comes out like in all its gory glory. Like the arm was never fucking attached.
Yeah.
The guy just goes, "I'll take this back," and it's like, "Whoa!"
They were temporary
stitches. Stitching.
You know?
Terrible
temporary stitches.
Yeah,
but if you haven't seen it, it's a really fun movie.
And also, great use of theremin.
Oh, yeah.
There's a theremin throughout the entire score, and it's super cool. And they rip off Reanimator with the opening credits sequence, where it's all these body parts floating across the screen, and it's cool. It totally tanked.
Yeah.
Totally tanked when it came out. Paramount put it out in 91. And I think I just read in Rue Morgue magazine that a town in the state of Wisconsin pulled all of the ads for body parts because the Jeffrey Dahmer shit started going down.
And he actually looks a little... He looks a little, you know, Dahmerish, I think.
Who, Jeffy?
Yeah, he does a little bit.
Yeah. I guess.
Yeah.
I don't
think. Let's take a poll. Let's take a Dahmer poll.
He's got those beautiful blue eyes.
But I do have to say, even though I am not personally a fan of the movie, which is the point of today, is you're defending ones that you think may have been overlooked or kind of disregarded, I will say that that does bring up one of the predominant tropes that we saw during the 1990s, which was the whole idea of technology and our own scientific advancements pushed too far. The whole kind of Lawnmower Man-esque idea, an unborn of...
Also Jeff Behe.
Also Jeff Behe.
That's true.
The whole idea of we might be able to do this, but it could be wrong and evil. So, yeah.
Yeah, because there is a mad scientist element to the movie. The doctor who attached the limb to Jeff Behe's body, she's a little unhinged, and she's got a greater purpose. And that's why she's kept the serial killer's head. But there's a great character actor who's also in it, the guy who plays the detective. Yeah. He's the bad guy in Serpent in a Rainbow, but he is fantastic in this as well. Yeah. So, yeah. Body parts.
Body parts.
We agreed. That's cool.
Yeah.
Good start. All right.
Nice. So I'm going to go with 1996's Freeway.
Oh, shit.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, diving right in without a horror film. Good job.
That is totally a fucking horror film.
It's
and
horror,
now
it's, not really horror.
It's on the bubble.
It's called Texas Frightmare, right?
Oh my god.
It's Freeway 2 Confessions of a Trick Baby.
Confessions of a Trick Baby.
I can't remember which one had this subtitle.
Vincent
I never
Gallo.
Thought
I'm
a movie
there.
That I saw at Blockbuster all the time when I worked at Blockbuster would come up as much as it does when I'm friends with you. Because this movie comes up all the fucking time.
Becca,
you just text me and go, Freeway.
You've been talking about Freeway for the 10 years I've known you.
For a long time. Because I am like passionate about this movie. Yeah, it's big. It's Little Red Riding Hood, but Freeway for me is somehow this director who hadn't done that much. His name was Matthew Bright. The only thing that he'd really done that became known was Forbidden Zone, which is like all types of batshit crazy in 1980. So like a decade and a half later, he convinces these A-list actors like Kiefer Sutherland and Reese Witherspoon and Amanda Plummer and Brooke Shields to make this seedy exploitation film where Reese Witherspoon plays an illiterate who runs away from home and ends up in the car of Kiefer Sutherland, who plays a serial killer.
Big Bad
hunting,
Wolf.
Yeah, Big Bad Wolf. And it's very much in the vein of Big Bad Wolf. Reese Witherspoon fights back, kicks his ass, and it kind of goes from there. But the whole thing... It's total exploitation. Like the whole thing, it is over the top and genius.
But glossy, like 90s glossy exploitation.
But it's shot like a big blockbuster film with these major A-list stars. But then you're just watching it and you're like, this movie is fucking batshit crazy. Yeah. I don't even know what's gonna happen. Kiefer Sutherland shows up with like this neck collar on, having the shit kicked out of him, trying to get her again.
Were you the one that kept renting it from my local Blockbuster on 34th and 3rd in Manhattan?
I owned a copy.
Jesus.
I owned a copy.
It was always out.
Yeah. Always. So I have always been a fan of this movie. It's perverse. It's pedophilic in parts because Kiefer Sutherland is playing an older dude and they play Reese Witherspoon is way too young. Like she's supposed to be like 14 in it. And she doesn't even look that young, but they play her as that young. And so, and there's these weird scenes where Reese will just be on camera by herself and she'll do these monologues to God. And she uses her actual Southern accent, but she gets like, she overdoes it. So it feels like a caricature where she's like, "Hello, God." And it's just like, and then she'll go on for like 3 minutes with these diatribes to God. And they are just so bizarre. It's weird. And if you happen to enjoy Freeway, same director, a couple years later, the same director-producer decided to see if lightning would strike twice. I don't even know how successful the first one was, but they decided to do it again with Freeway 2, Confessions of a Trick Baby, which is about a girls' juvenile delinquent facility where all of the girls are bulimic. Two of them decide to escape, but then one realizes that the other one's a serial killer and they're running cross-country together, but they end up, she keeps saying that they have to get to this convent that protected her when she was a kid, so they run to this convent in Mexico, which is run by Vincent Gallo in drag, but then they find out that the convent is actually promoting cannibalism, and there's more. I don't even have
honestly,
to go
like,
on.
Which one are you advocating for?
I know.
Part two. All right, turn off the lights. We're watching this fucking thing.
How many people have seen this movie? How many people
number
have seen
two, it? Number two.
Number right. two.
These are
one and two.
One and
these
two,
are
yeah.
my people.
One you can find on DVD. Two is only on VHS, but it is
two lives
so,
in our hearts.
It is worth getting a VHS player just to see that craziness.
And,
so.
And a really quick tidbit about writer-director Matthew Bright, who did Freeway and Freeway 2. He also did the Ted Bundy movie from 2002. Yeah. But more importantly, his last movie, because it plays to him getting these all-star casts to do the most obscure things. He did a movie called Tiptoes in 2003. Yeah.
Gary Oldman.
Have you ever heard of this? Go on YouTube immediately look at the trailer for Tiptoes, because it stars Matthew McConaughey, whose brother is a dwarf, played by Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
And oh, this it is so Matthew Bright.
Disturbing
yeah,
to
a weird
see
movie.
Gary Oldman edited in a way that he looks like a little person.
Yeah.
And offensive.
Yeah. And offensive. That kind of sums up all of this guy's movies. Yeah. So,
he's got a style.
Yeah. So I highly recommend seeking out Freeway and Freeway 2.
Right Alrighty. On. So I quickly adjusted my number one because of Body Parts. Body Parts was my original number one, but this one was kind of like waiting in the wings. And it's a film called Z-Ram. I don't know if anybody's seen Z-Ram, right?
No.
No one? It's from 1991. Yeah! There we go.
The Z-Ram fan.
So let's take you back to 1991. Little Ryan Turek in high school had no girlfriends, but he really liked anime, manga, the Guyver. Guyver, anyone?
Yeah, I remember Guyver.
Watched a lot of Akira. Called Japan a lot for model kits. I would call Japan and be like, "Hey guys, get that Godzilla versus Mothra model kit because I really want it." And then my dad would call and be like, "What is this $50 phone bill to Japan?" I was like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I was just ordering some model kits." So along this journey of calling Japan and buying Japanese magazines and stuff, I was introduced to Z-Ram, and Z-Ram is a horror sci-fi actioner that is about a bounty hunter who. Is tracking this alien that lands on Earth and threatens to devastate the entire planet unless she stops him. But what the creature does, he's like this big bulky dude. He's got like kind of a RoboCop visor. He's got a wide-brimmed hat thing that he wears. And then in the center of it is this like little Japanese lady's face. And it comes out like it comes out of his head like an alien mouth thing. And it like eats people. And it'll come out and punch you in the face, and then your head's devastated. But Z-Ram can do a lot of other things. He can ingest you, and you're kept alive for a little while you're inside him. He can spit out clones of himself, and these clones are very inferior, and they look like little maggot people, and they wander around and attack other people. But the gist of the movie is Iria, who is the bounty hunter, she tracks Z-Ram to Earth. She ropes in these two dopey engineers who get stuck in Z-Ram's alternate universe where she can do battle with him until she either wins or loses, and the fate of the planet is hanging in the balance.
I don't
lost
believe this is a movie.
This is a very complicated movie.
So it spawned. Turing
wrote this up.
I did not. I did not. It's actually it's pretty amazing. It's got a great score. I used to have the score. And they spun it off into a sequel, and there was an anime series. And yeah, it was a huge hit.
And yet only one other person has seen anything to do with
this
here.
Is this on DVD?
That's remarkable.
Or is this
I
like
can't say. If you guys, I've not been able to find it on DVD or Blu-ray. Yeah, yeah, look up Z-Ram. What's that? It is on DVD now. Oh, perfect. That's great.
There was a Z-Ram market, somebody thought.
No, totally. Absolutely. No, but it's a fun Terminator 2-esque kind of action movie with a lot of horror elements. There's a lot of gore. There's a bunch of scares. There's a moment in which Z-Ram is able to take his head off and he throws it and like it starts eating people. It's fucking amazing. Let me just tell you this thing.
He takes the head off and the head eats people.
Yes.
Okay.
So anyways, I'm going to blow, yeah, just want to blow your minds with a little Z-Ram. I wanted to give it a mention. Sam and I were texting. I was like, I'm dropping Z-Ram on you. And he was like, what? But it's definitely an acquired taste. If you guys are into movies like The Guyver, anybody?
Yeah.
Little Steve Wang, you know.
Don't humor him. Just stop it. Okay, this is gonna get. We need more beer. Beer run at the back. Whoever's at the back, you're on charge. Yeah, you.
But this the whole thing. This whole topic was overlooked and unloved. So yeah. This movie was definitely overlooked, except for those who were at Chiller Theater with me, buying the model kits for the one screening. But yeah, check it out. It's fucking weird. The special effects are very 90s, but very ambitious. It's overall just an ambitious movie. In the sequel, they like kicked it up a notch. It's insane. But it's the same scenario where these two dopey engineers get back in this like dimension and they're like, oh, come on, guys. Didn't you learn the first time? So anyways, Z-Ram, check it out. Sam, follow it up with that.
I'm ready.
Z-Ram.
This was an interesting topic. I was talking to Ryan a bit about what it means to be sort of overlooked and unloved now, especially since we're living in a time with Arrow and Scream Factory and all this stuff, because 3 years ago, if you were like, what is the most overlooked horror movie of the 90s? I would have been like, Tales from the Hood, 100%.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's a fucking great movie and never gets its due. And now it's out on Scream Factory. I feel like that's not the case anymore, right? Like, people are appreciating it. So this is sort of in connection with that because it's just come out on Blu-ray. I feel like it's a film that's long, long overdue for love. It's called Dark Waters.
Oh, yeah.
Mariano Bino's film. And it's just like a transcendent movie. It's both nunsploitation and art horror. Mm-hmm. And it's this film where this girl goes to this mysterious convent on a mysterious island to find out what the hell, like, why is she being drawn there? And it's just a barrage of image. And I love that shit. Like, just give me nightmare images and nightmare logic and nonsense. And that's what this movie is. And I know you're a big fan of it.
Yeah, it
as
gets
well.
Really Lovecraftian, too.
Super Lovecraftian. Mm-hmm. It's gorgeous. It's like a
is
gorgeous
Severin
movie.
Put that one out recently?
Yeah, like just last week.
Yeah,
and you could buy it at their booth.
Yeah.
It's just really beautiful, and I think we're living in a time where a lot of people are like, art horror, and I'm like, this has been around forever, and it fucking rules, so please go watch it.
And when
it
you're saying art horror, you're talking about like The Witch, and It Follows.
Yeah. I think people have a little chip on their shoulder about like slower movies, weirder movies, movies that are like super beautiful but also super gnarly and strange. And I don't think it's a new thing. Yeah. It sort of never has been. Oh. And Dark Waters is a really great example of that, and it's a really great overlooked example of that. There's just like giant beach images with like fish.
Yes.
Just dead fish. And you're like, what the fuck is that?
Well, it's
you thought Z-Ray was weird. Come on.
Dead fish. I don't know how to do that.
Like, right. I see shot. I'm like, how did he shoot? Did he kill all those fish? Yeah. I don't know how he did that.
I don't know.
That.
Ask Mariano.
No. And his stories about making it are absolutely crazy, but it is one of those movies that you will watch and then you will go, how the hell did he do that? Because even past the dead fish, there, because it is set on this like rocky island, and it's at this convent. But
it's like
convent,
jagged. It's a very like jarring, jagged.
And the convent goes down into the island. So huge amounts of the convent are with like these jagged walls inside this island. And it's amazing looking. And so to figure out like, you know, the location and how he did this. And plus, he shot it. There was a couple of different countries involved. Mm-hmm. And I know that there was some war going on with one of the countries while he was shooting it. And so the stories behind how he made it and got some of the shots are epic.
And it's like, I haven't rewatched the Blu-ray yet. Like, I have it at home. I haven't put it on yet. So a lot of what I'm going off of is I haven't seen this movie in years. But that's part of the reason I picked it is because I've seen this movie years ago and it's always sort of living right here. Mm-hmm. And if I'm remembering correctly, she's always looking through this like little hole in this like stone wall. And there's just this thing and it's pulsating. And it's like one of the most textured like images I've seen of something like that, where you're like, what the fuck is beyond that wall?
Do you
and you're like bothered by it?
Do you ever avoid rewatching that stuff? I mean, it's something we often discuss on the show, but like I know for me, if I get something in my head, especially art horror, things that are just different. Yeah. I don't want to revisit it, because sometimes I revisit it and I'm disappointed with it. But the thing in your memory that burns, that it's abstraction
sort of,
is
Well, it's sort exciting. Of also that great feeling of like, you know, when you watch something, you're really tired and you just keep waking up during like the really gnarly parts. Yeah, like that's your vision of the
like
movie.
The Beyond. When we go to the Beyond at midnight,
oh
and we're
in.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And you sort of feel high because you're just like, oh, what's behind that wall?
I'll never know because I slept through
that. Yeah, exactly.
But with Dark Water, there's also so much water imagery to the point, and it does things. That's the other crazy thing is you're like, did he actually direct water? Like, get it to do things for him? Because it feels like it. Like, sometimes the water is
that
slow
has to be a quote
flowing.
For the show.
Did he actually direct water? Water? And sometimes the water is sharp, and sometimes it's got really jagged points, and it's like, well, how the fuck did he do that?
I think what you're speaking to... you know, like, I hope he directed water. But I think what you're speaking to is, like, a quality that a lot of films strive for but they never get, which the movie feels occult.
Yes.
Like, it feels like there's some sort of, like, dark alchemy involved in this film, and that's why it affects you so deeply.
Yeah.
And it has affected me deeply for many years, and I can't wait to revisit it when I get home. But it's a really gnarly movie.
Yeah.
So, Dark Waters.
Have you seen it, Ulrich?
No,
I think it's right up your alley.
Yeah, literally walk across the hall and buy it tonight.
It's wonderful.
Well, yeah, and in truth, of all the people I followed on... when you took over Shock for a while, I would always laugh because we were bi-coastal and we didn't really know each other, but I would always go, oh yeah, we have almost
literally
the same
taste. Yeah.
But occasionally there'll be one movie that you love and I go, oh yeah, I hate it, or vice versa. So it's kind of fun. We don't get to argue as much. Our show would be boring compared to me and Becca.
Oh, absolutely.
We get to fight like cats and dogs.
We'd just be like, oh, did you ever see this movie?
Yes, it's great. Like it. Cool. I love that shot with the wallpaper and the dead fish. How'd they do the fish?
Oh, whoa. That's rad.
So many fish. I wonder if they directed water.
Mm.
Who knows?
For me, anyone that listens to the show, and even if you don't, I will tell you now, I have a soft spot for horror comedy. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I just love it. I love regular horror, but I can't take horror seriously sometimes, and I just like over-the-top gore. I love the Evil Dead movies. I love Dead Alive. Mm. Things in that vein. Mm. So I'm going to 1999, and I'm going to take
99.
A little movie called Idle Hands.
Mm. Yes.
That's right.
Rodman.
Solid, you know what? Choice. I hope the director Rodman heard that applause, because he really doesn't think that any of you guys like it for some reason. But it's a great little movie, and it came out in a really weird time because, again, it was at the tail end of all the kind of Scream knockoffs. Yeah. And it's a hard R movie. It's really goofy and funny about a bunch of stoners, and one of them is so, I guess, it's a spirit kind of inhabits his hand and takes it over, and it's because he's probably the most lazy human being on the planet, hence the easiest to take over. Mm-hmm. I think that's the gist of it. And then what follows is it's very much just Evil Dead 2, where the hand wants to kill people and actually is while he's asleep, because he gets stoned and passed out, and then somebody gets murdered in town, and his hand went out and did it. But, you know, then it's really fun. Like, Seth Green's in it, and what's the other guy who's foggy on Daredevil now? I forget his name.
Oh, yeah. That's where he's from.
Yeah.
Oh, he's from there. That. Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't realize that.
What's his name? That's it. Eldon Helenson. They're his best friends, and he accidentally kills them both. Yeah. But very much like American Werewolf in London, they refuse to die. And like, they even say, they're like, what happened? Like, what we saw is, like, white light. But, dude, it was really far away. So we're just going to chill here. And, like, they have, like, you know, half his head is falling off and stuff with a beer bottle in it. But it's really, really funny. And it's also a really good Halloween movie.
I was going to say, I remember it being, like, a really, not to use this word again, but, like, textured Halloween movie. Like, you
very
see Halloween all over the place.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, when it's, like, late September, October, you feel like you want to watch a bunch of Halloween movies. And this is a great one. They even end up at a Halloween dance, which is great because I kind of hate The Offspring. Or at least
this is my only qualm with the movie.
Offspring.
So The Offspring are in it,
weirdly
covering an AFI song. And it's like, you just get AFI.
It feels weird.
The Offspring's in it, and they get killed
Sam,
by the hands.
I love that you know that detail.
Well, I was like, why can't you just AFI? Like, put AFI on. Like, no one knew who AFI was at the time. Everyone would see the movie and be like, oh, shit, AFI's
I thought
tight.
They wanted to cover a Ramones song and weren't allowed to. That might be the hint of it. But the point is, the movie, here's why it didn't do well. Because it was a really weird horror comedy that came out exactly when Columbine happened.
Mm-hmm.
And anything to do with a kid, even if he's a stoner with a possessed hand, killing other teenage kids was like, ugh. You know,
we can't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it didn't do well, but it's I watch it. I just revisited it last Halloween. I think it's such a blast, and it deserves. It doesn't have a special edition Blu-ray or anything, yeah. and it deserves a lot more credit. So.
What's the studio behind it? Do you remember?
I don't know off the top of my hand. Yeah. It might be like Paramount or Sony, one of the big
and
ones.
And kind of a fun love story, too. Jessica Alba's really charming in it.
It's like her first
she's
movie.
She's like a proactive lead. She's like always
great.
Trying to help him out. And
yeah, a lot of people are like really fun in the movie. Like Vivica Fox is super fun in it, like hunting the hand.
And
there's
just,
like the neighbor who only listens to 80s metal.
Yeah.
And just totally random, and this is why I think this movie deserves a cult following is because I became friends with Rodman, who made it, because he also did the classic Leprechaun 2, and I did the commentary with him for that. But we went to go see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre together, the 40th anniversary, and literally someone behind us in line was like, I'm Leatherface, which is a quote from Idle Hands. So I thought that was kind of neat that somebody did Seth Green's Leatherface imitation while we were in line.
Awesome.
Well, I don't know. I kind of
second round.
When I was planning this, I thought at one stage we had discussed doing like ones that we thought we were having to fight to defend because they were marginalized. So half my list was those kind of titles, and then we went more for underrated. So I don't know. I've got good movies, but then I have movies. I'm gonna go for a fun
just
movie.
Pick one.
Go fun.
All right, The Relic.
Holy
you
shit!
Know, I knew one of
the
you
relic.
Two.
We talked about this.
Peter Himes.
We joked about this literally on text. And we were like, "Someone's going to bring the relic to the table."
I didn't
think it would be you.
I thought you guys thought it was going to be me.
I thought it was going to be
because usually if it's a giant monster, I'm like, "Oh, I fucking love that monster."
I actually only chose it just to kind of fuck her over. If I got it, I'm going to be honest. I don't even like
the
movie. I just
Elric. This movie can be summed up with one scene.
Yeah, yeah.
The no scene.
The no scene.
With do you remember this?
Yeah.
The SWAT guy gets pulled out.
Yeah. And all the shots in the museum. So who's seen The Relic? Do you guys remember this movie?
I mean, holy shit.
This is a movie. Now, I'm going to be honest.
It's
I haven't seen
Netflix.
It for a long
Everybody's
time.
Everybody's seen it.
How many people read the book?
There's a book?
Yeah.
One, two. Yeah, The Relic is based on a book. It was a big, hot property that was optioned by the studio, and then it became a very studio movie. The book is fucking awesome.
Who here has listened to the Tom Sizemore audio tape version? Nope. Yeah, because I'm also lying to you.
I don't think he would get through that.
No, he probably wouldn't get through. But Tom Sizemore, this is like peak Tom Sizemore. This film is probably the last like big monster movie that I thought was super entertaining in the vein of Aliens and movies like that because they just don't make big monster rampaging movies anymore. Splinter was maybe the only other one I can think of, which is pretty good.
But even that, they definitely kept, in Splinter, they kept the monster more kind of shadowed and not displayed like it is in Relic, where it's like the monster has a name, it's like Cahogath or something like that.
Cathoga.
Cathoga, thank you.
It's the hypothalamus. It feasts on, I believe.
It feasts on your hypothalamus.
Yeah. And is it a Chicago? I can't remember.
It's
a
Chicago
museum.
Chicago,
the museum seems
assigned. Which, for some reason, it's a natural history museum, but for some reason, they're doing something on superstition.
Yeah.
It's totally weird.
It's in, yeah, I think the books were set in New York, and then they moved to Chicago. I wanted to be a PA on the movie so badly. I was like fresh out of film school, and I wrote to the production office, and I was like, I really love the book, and I cannot be to be part of this film. Please take me.
I actually have no idea. Did it do well? Because I started in the theater. No, it didn't do well.
I don't think it did
well.
See,
to me, okay, this is a great thing about being a kid, or not a teenager, whatever it was, is you have no concept of that. This is a little bit pre-IMDb, I believe. So in my mind, The Relic's a big fucking success. So I watch this movie and go, oh, everyone's in the theater, and oh, it's a big monster, and oh, this is a good movie. And I walk out going, that was a hit. And I have no idea of the reality of the world. Just like I wanted Tommy Jarvis to become Jason. I'm like, after Friday, oh, of course. So anyway, so I thought it was a really fun movie. I haven't seen it probably almost since then. But I was kind of pulling it as one no one talks about. Because also, I think Stan Winston did the effects, right? Himes directed.
Wait a minute. Did he?
Yeah.
My vague
I think
memory.
It's a Winston monster.
But here's my vague memory of The Relic, and correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah. But I remember seeing The Relic in theaters, and because it's the Tom Sizemore one. And my beef with it is it's really terrible CGI from the very early stages of CGI.
Winston Crash
like
McCreary, who did a lot of the Jurassic Park illustrations. When you see the T-Rex from Jurassic Park, it's an artist named Crash McCreary, and he did a lot of art for the Relic. But it was Stan Winston's shop that put it together, and there were a lot of practical creature stuff. But when he starts climbing up the walls with his little suction feet, that's all like CGI. Yeah.
So that's my strong memory, and that's why at the time I preferred Mimic, because Mimic had come out shortly after that.
Yeah.
And that one's not as great either, But I just, I've, of the two, I was like, oh, Relic Mimic.
I bet if you rewatch this both, Del Toro you'd go guys Relic. Are right. I would guess.
I don't know. I love Mira Sorvino.
But the scene where they're rubbing insect organs on a subway. It's like, oh, we
both
were there.
Better than Mothman. Yep. But Himes is really good at shooting that the film in the dark. There's a lot of scenes in like pitch darkness and just the creature being highlighted. He also made 2010. He made Outland. He's like a really solid director. So it felt like if B movie that could have been like a Corman production done as an A-list movie. And I think I got to rewatch it myself before I recommend it to you, which I just did. That's me in a nutshell. I know I loved it as a young person. I thought it was a great movie, and I just wish there was more big monster movies. Even when they're dumb, there's something just fun about them. And I think that they are scary. I see why they're scary to approach. And funny that you said the thing about CGI. No, my memory is purely of seeing the monster and not CGI. So the memory of something, again, would change if I saw it tomorrow, I'm sure.
Sorry, just because I see a parallel here with like you talking about a B-movie with like high-end production. Yeah. I can imagine this happening to a movie from this year that in like 10 years, 15 years, everyone's like, this movie's tight, but it didn't do well. Life that came out 2 months ago, the space horror movie.
Yes. Don't tell Ryan. Really good.
So, I think you talked about it, but it's like mean, gnarly space horror movie with some really interesting deaths, really fun.
Interesting cast. Yeah. You know, they brought a cast to the table, and I think through favors, and the cast was like, sure, why not? We'll do this crazy movie.
And it's like a rad movie, and I think like the same, it's going to have the same fate where in like 10, 15 years, we're like, man, life is cool as shit.
Nice.
But yeah.
So for my next one, I went with one that I think is criminally underrated, and that is 1991's La Setta, also known as The Devil's Daughter. Are you guys familiar with this one?
No. The Sect. Is that
the
Sect?
Yeah.
The Sect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I rented it.
By the title we know, damn it.
I rented it under Devil's Daughter.
How many of us do you think actually know what it is? But once we said The Sect, we're like, this is our opportunity.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we know
that. Yeah, you're stupid, Becky. Yeah. No, no.
Everybody. I've all heard of Cemetery Man, right? Cemetery Man?
Yeah.
Yes.
So this is
same director.
Michel Soavi, same director. He also did Stage Fright, which is absolutely beautiful if you've not seen Stage Fright. It's like an 80s giallo film that it's just beautiful.
Are you the only person that pronounces it giallo?
Giallo.
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 I'm not correcting you.
I don't know.
It's open to interpretation.
Giallo?
Giallo.
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 Hard G. I like it.
I'm going with Giallo.
Worst moments in podcasting right there. Also, he was Dario Argento's assistant for many movies and literally learned from the maestros.
And so Dario produced this movie, and it's directed by the same guy who did Cemetery Man and Stage Fright. And so just a brilliant filmmaker. The movie itself is it's kind of a fever dream. Yeah. So it definitely has more of like a stream of conscious feel to it, which it is very similar to a lot of Italian films in that manner. It's about a woman who accidentally hits this guy with her car. And she decides to take him home with her to make sure that he's okay. And once she gets him home, she realizes that there's something wrong. He's kind of obsessed. And then she realizes that certain things in her life are getting weird. She keeps seeing the same people over and over. She finds this weird well in the basement of her house that she never even knew was there. And some beautiful imagery there where it's down this crazy tunnel and she's like, I've never seen this before. And so a lot of the movie is built out of this imagery. And then the whole kind of thing is that she is pregnant with the devil's child, and that these people, this witch sect, is trying to get to her, and they have these keys, and they have seven keys or a certain number of keys, and they have to insert them into somebody's face, remove the face, and then that becomes the keyhole through which they can like bring the devil back.
In other words, imagine it was called Mother of Tears, and that's the end of the trilogy of Argento, and it's much better.
Yeah,
just perfect ending.
It is so good. It is so beautiful. And if you're a fan of Italian cinema, this one was definitely late to the game. But if you're a fan of like Fulci and some of the slower Italian films, this is like right there with it, and it's fantastic and gorgeous and really difficult to come by. I remember seeing it on VHS when I was a kid. It just had this girl in blonde holding a snake was the VHS box
cover. That was after The Church, right?
Mm-hmm.
And his career was kind of he stepped away from his career after losing a child around there, and he was definitely on the trajectory to become the heir apparent to Lamberto Bava and Dario Argento in a lot of ways, and then he just had to step away from the industry. And I've heard he's coming back now, which is
he actually just did an Italian crime show.
Cool.
Oh, really?
Yeah, through work stuff, I've seen some episodes. Yeah. It's very normal detective stuff, but it was really interesting to see an episode and then it's like directed by Michelle Sub.
Is it still that stylish shooting style?
No, I mean it's just a different world that he's working in.
Yeah.
I'll check it out.
So that is.
I remember he was talking
the
about
the sect, aka Lucita, aka the Devil's Daughter.
Devil's Daughter. I just remember him.
You're only legit if you have three titles.
I know.
I just remember him going into press talking about trying to bring Cemetery Man back to a degree or something,
oh
some
my
way,
gosh.
And then working with Nick Cage. I remember
what?
That too. Yeah, he
really?
Wanted to work with Nick Cage on something.
Oh,
that's very weird. Very weird. All right, so moving up into the 90s, I want to drop a film called Full Eclipse, which came out in 1993 by Anthony Hickox. Anyone? Full Eclipse. Thank
God.
No. Maybe. Not even you.
It's the same plot right, that you put in earlier.
Thank you. So this was a movie that played often on HBO. It was an HBO original that hit at just the right time for me because I was reading comic books. I was drawing a lot. He's in the all right. Someone way in the back.
Yeah, but
thank
he's in
you.
The dark. He doesn't count. Come into the light, sir.
And it was just like one of those movies where you know my dad and I would like look at the HBO listings and go, oh, Full Eclipse. That sounds rad. Let's just tape it. And it played at like midnight, and I would watch it the next morning. And this is a little gem. Hickox did, of course. Yes, thank you.
You didn't tell me MVP's in it.
Dude, so MVP. Right, let me get Beatles. Well, Barrett, don't. Hang on. Hang on.
Whoa, he just
so Hickox, let's put Hickox, who gave us Hellraiser 3.
Yeah, I'm pulling
and Waxworks.
Waxworks.
And pair him with Mario Van Peebles.
What?
And
okay.
He plays an L.A. cop who is welcomed into a special task force led by Bruce Payne. Bruce Payne, 90s staple. And Patsy Kensit from Lethal Weapon 2 is part of the group. Paula Marshall from Hellraiser 3 is also part of this group. And basically what they do is they're a bunch of cops who take a special drug and then...
I've never seen that.
You guys... What? Oh, my God. So they take a special drug and then they fucking wolf out. And they become like not wolf men because they don't go full werewolf, but they basically are like... Chris Claremont era X-Men Wolverine type guys.
Is this their like crime fighting strategy or?
Yes, they go after the worst drug dealers in LA and they like swim through rivers and they like carry guns, but these claws come out of their knuckles like Wolverine.
So instead of getting SWAT gear, they decide to turn into werewolves.
Yes.
Whoa,
because why not?
You were just like, I love stream of conscious Italian movies.
I know.
Let this nonsense have its day.
Which is opening a gate to hell, police werewolves.
No, but I mean like, what the hell? So basically, it's like taking a steroid. It's a whole like allegory for taking steroids. And when you take too much steroids, you get a little mentally unhinged. And if you take too much of this drug, then you might just go full werewolf. And the werewolf in this case is a giant, awful bear costume that Bruce Payne morphs into and must battle with MVP. And this is a very, very special movie because you should be. It's a very, very special movie because it comes with all of like the Hickoxisms that we come to know and love from Hellraiser 3. So you've got high style, some ambitious action, some ambitious horror, women with really extreme eyebrows, and you never saw anything like this in the early 90s. Like it's who was it? Who was the filmmaker? Jonas who did Cub.
Govertz.
Oh,
Govertz. Yeah. So I saw him like waxing poetic about this film. He like caught it and he's like, "Man, this is like an X-Men movie that never like they never like just slapped the X-Men brand on it." And I was like, "Yes," because I was refashioning my X-Men figures into these fucking things.
Oh my god.
I had my own MVP action figure. I was really into this movie. It was so awesome.
The same period you didn't have a girlfriend, or was this like later?
Did she help you sculpt your X-Men figures?
This did not happen. Yeah, no, there was no special lady in my high school.
Were you trying to explain? I have a history of trying to explain Anthony Hickox movies to my girlfriend. I was trying to tell her about Hellraiser 3 recently, and just like this movie.
Well,
she was like the entire time just like nope. And I was like, yeah, but he's like a CD Cenobite, and she's like nope. And I was like, it's rad.
It's HBO was doing some weird stuff in the early 90s. You know, we had Cast a Deadly Spell.
Hell yeah.
Which
we
is
had
great.
Late 80s. The Hitcher. So The Hitcher.
Would play all the time, yeah.
Cast a Deadly Spell, Full Eclipse are all HBO movies. So that's why we're not getting Blu-rays of these. We're not seeing proper. There was a proper DVD release. But I'm trying to show Full Eclipse at CineFamily in L.A. And it's becoming very, very difficult. And I'm like, just fuck it, guys. I'm going to rent the theater, and I'm going to show you my DVD. And Josh Miller, who runs Friday Night Frights at Cinema, he's like, I've never heard of this. And I'm like, dude, X-Wolves on steroids, and he was all in. You can guarantee that there's a pretty intense and passionate sex scene with MVP and Patsy Kensit and go full wolf mode. You got Bruce Payne, who there's a moment in which he goes like this, and he goes, I can smell your fear. I'm trying to think of some other gems. There's some great stuff, guys. I mean, like even the costume design is completely borrowed from early 90s X-Men. It's insane.
You had me at Mario Van Peebles versus Werewolf.
Yeah.
What more do you need to sell this movie?
It's pretty incredible. You also got a great scene where he's in an air duct. There's an opening sequence in a nightclub where a bunch of assholes are holding a bunch of women hostage, and Mario Van Peebles climbs through an air duct, and then he kicks out the grate, and he's like, no! And he does this full John Woo slow jump down onto the dance floor while blasting people. It's amazing. It is amazing. I love this movie so much. You can get it on Amazon. Tell Amazon I sent you to get Full Eclipse. Oh, it's only $12.
Wow, that was committed.
This has nothing. Speaking of Amazon, this has zero to do with the 90s, but Fade to Black now on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, Fade to Black on Amazon Prime. Amazing. Hey, Sam, can you get Full Eclipse on Shudder so you can bestow?
Actually, do you have any idea how they could have pulled that off?
Yeah, because
Fade to Black had
so many rights.
With
the zero music idea because and the movies. Because Fade to Black was just, it was a rights nightmare. It's one that's like, it's well known for being underrated because it's been stuck in like VHS hell. I think it did a limited DVD release briefly, but got really expensive, and it was never able to really get released past that because the character in it dresses up as characters from movies and then quotes lines and plays the soundtrack.
Which, like, that's fine, but there's constant, like, footage. Like,
he has flashbacks to old movies, so you'll see Creature from Black Lagoon.
And so it's like a licensing nightmare. So I know a number of companies had been trying for a long time to try to network it and figure it out, but none had been able to. So
it's on Amazon Prime.
It's hard to fight for too much.
There's another movie I would maybe kill to put on Shudder, but unfortunately, and it's not as interesting with rights, it's just like no one knows where they are, but Pin, A Plastic Nightmare.
Oh my gosh,
I'm a big fan.
A wonderful film.
Sam, you're right, that is a great film.
Hell yeah.
It's one of my favorites. I'm pinning. Sorry, I was pinning.
Is that pinning?
It's an inside
pin.
Pinny Kane. It's my
Sam.
Go for it.
Sam,
you're up.
Oh, you know what? I didn't come prepared with this film because I watched it on the plane, but I'm going to talk about it.
Keep talking.
We have leaned in, Sam.
Trying to be inconspicuous about talking to the other members of the group.
Yeah, I know.
Just talk openly. Let's just
be open. What do you got?
I was on the plane scrolling through what was available, and I saw a movie that I hadn't seen since I was a kid. It used to play on HBO all the time, came out around 95, 96, and I don't remember ever seeing it in full, but a lot of aspects of it frightened me, and it's not a scary movie. It's more of like a supernatural noir, a supernatural mystery. It's a period piece called Eve's Bayou.
And it's a good movie.
Really, really.
Horror?
It's very debatable, but there is voodoo. There's hard supernatural stuff in it. I think it's worth talking about.
It's an emotional film.
Yeah.
Very emotional film, but really good movie. And I was really excited to revisit it on the plane and really like kind of take it in. But it is this period piece set in the South, set in Louisiana, I imagine, because there's a lot of voodoo and a lot of Creole spoken. About a young girl coming of age, and her father, Samuel L. Jackson, is a town doctor. Everyone loves him. Finds out he's cheating, but her aunt has a psychic gift. There is another psychic in town. There's a lot of anguish. There's a lot of supernatural reckoning throughout her sort of tumultuous childhood. And it's like a really just like rich movie. Like, you feel the Southern Gothic. The score is really good. It's really like twangy. The flashbacks are really stylized. It's black and white. When her Aunt Roselle does these readings, there's like these really cool black and white stylized of people sort of floating on the river while they're in their own, you know, settings with which she's seeing them. So she's seeing some guy kind of shooting up and telling someone that's where your son is, but like he's on the river. There's like a folklore nature to it, so it's sort of like what American folk horror might be like, and you sort of wonder that since folk horror is such a inherently British thing, and like obviously the witch is folk horror, but this kind of coming deep from within the South and voodoo, and it's just a really cool movie. It's a really emotional movie. The final shot is like a tremendous shot. It's just beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's a cool movie. I really liked revisiting it. And Samuel L. Jackson's amazing, and it's like really, you know, it's always exciting to be reminded how good of an actor he is.
I was just reminded of the cool thing about our show. When we do it in the studio, we don't hear walkouts. There's something really sad and harrowing about that.
Someone's like,
sound.
I'm not rewatching. Why?
That's like someone. It's like someone unsubscribed from our feed.
Yeah. I'm not downloading that.
It's a live unsubscription. They're like, fuck these guys.
It's because I keep bringing it down. Ryan's like, Wolf. Satan. And I'm like, Eve's Bayou. It's a very emotional film. It's very good.
We just want consistency, man.
I know, sorry. But it's a good movie.
I'm going to go with a very unpopular one where I will probably lose 90% of the people in this room. But I think Elric Kane is going to back me up.
Dude, I think I've written it down.
All right, hold on. Hear me out before you start throwing tomatoes, okay? I love franchises in general. Obviously, I'm going for a commercial movie here.
Hold it.
I think Elric has it on his list.
Here's the thing.
Wait.
Everybody, wait. Here's the thing. I get in marathon mode just like all of you. Sometimes like a new movie's coming out. I was like, well, I got to watch them all in a row. And what happens is as you watch them consecutively. Oh, thank you, Mick, for bringing beer.
Dear.
Holy shit.
It took an Australian.
You know what? I'm going to need this for what he's about to say.
Yeah, we all need to have. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
But so we all need a drink before.
I'll take a drink when he reveals this shit title.
When you when
not shit.
So when you watch a movie in order, obviously you get to a point where you know, you're like, oh, this is a franchise getting terrible and terrible. But what I do now with remakes, sequels, is I watch them completely out of context and pretend none of the other movies exist. And just is like, is this a fun movie? So Elric came over one Friday the 13th. And I was like, you know what? Fuck it. Let's go for the unrated Jason Goes to Hell. And
yeah.
And you know what?
The rest of you can leave.
You even said.
You guys are
can
all
I walk
your
out?
Minds.
Like, can
yeah,
I do that?
You can.
And it was, I mean.
Well, we watched the unrated cut, which isn't what we saw in theaters, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And
that
it was
absolutely
way
correct.
Better.
Yes. And I mean, look, as a Friday the 13th movie, it doesn't succeed in continuing what you're used to from the Jason Voorhees saga. But if you look at it and pretend Jason doesn't exist, but like, you know, 80s slasher movies, you know, the typical trope of them, like this movie starts with like a girl going to a cabin.
It's what the best opening of all the series, I think.
Yeah. It's
that's
a great
the one
opening.
Part you can't argue. It's a great opening.
So it's like the traditional 80s slasher trope with a girl going to a cabin, blah, blah, blah. And then Jason shows up and
she has a shower.
Killer,
she has a shower.
Does the shower scene.
It's the first 10 minutes. You have to have nudity and then the kill.
All of it. It hits like all those checkpoints. And then a SWAT team shows up and blows Jason up.
No, she's in the shower and then she does a dive roll out and you're suddenly
because
like, wait a minute, what am I watching? And she's an FBI agent.
It's because she's FBI. And you're like,
so
what?
Cool.
And then they just blow Jason apart. But
imagine,
you know,
imagine staking out Jason Voorhees.
I know. I love that.
I love that. It's so good.
You picture two cops there with their cups of coffee. What if they were the werewolf cops? I have made the greatest movie ever.
Cross-section.
Right there. Inception.
You just brought me back into the conversation. I think this is a terrific idea. Especially if you give the werewolf serum to Jason Voorhees. Then he's got fucking claws coming
Jason.
Out.
Jason! Can he defeat the
Jason
werewolf
still,
cops?
It'll still be better.
Oh,
it'll still be better than Jason Goes to Hell.
Okay, so let's ignore that his name is Jason.
Yeah.
So FBI, a girl, goes to.
You
cannot ignore
no
him.
No argument.
Out of context. Jason Goes to Hell.
Out of first of all, stop talking over me, all of you, because I don't do that to any of you.
There you go.
That's number one. Number two, out of context. Every plot that you guys described tonight is the most ridiculous, insane shit I've ever fucking heard.
Yeah.
Okay, so shut up for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Some girl goes to a camp, okay? She goes to a cabin. You're like, oh, she's going to shower. She's going to get slashed by some killer. The killer shows up. She's a fucking FBI agent, and they blow him apart. Mm-hmm. Then they take the remains of the body, and the coroner eats the heart of this killer.
Because he couldn't resist.
And now all of a sudden, he's crazy. That killer. And this killer keeps vomiting this heart out into other people's bodies to keep this body because he wants his old body back. And then you got a lead character who's kind of, for lack of a better term, kind of like a nerd.
And he's from the Friday the 13th TV show.
Series.
So there's perfect integration of concept there.
And there's good comedy. And then, you know, Creighton Duke has that wonderful line about a donut and a hot dog, which I still don't understand.
When I think about Jason, I think about a little girl with pigtails trying to put a hot dog through a donut hole.
Out of nowhere in the story and never explained. I think in a commentary, he's just like, I don't know, it's high as shit. That's what I imagine.
Out of context, great line.
Yes, a brilliant line.
So the point is, me and Elric watch it, and Honestly, the unrated cut does make a world of difference.
The gore in that tent scene was amazing.
Because K&B did the effects for it, and they did it, and it's some of the best work they've ever done, and it didn't end up on the R-rated cut. The unrated one, I think, is out of print now on DVD, but it's funny, that box, even the box set's out of print now. They did a Blu-ray box set, and the version of it on there is rated R, but if you... it comes with the digital downloads, and even though it says it's R, for some reason the version that's on digital is the unrated cut, so we could have watched it in HD instead of that DVD. But point being, we had a blast watching it, and no, it's not my favorite Friday 13th movie, but considering the plot lines these guys have described to you all night, I don't think that plot I just said is very far off, so there.
And I think it's probably the best sequel to The Hidden I've seen.
it's better than The Hidden 2.
It's not a Jason movie, it's a hidden sequel. If you haven't seen The Hidden, it's the exact same story.
I found a hidden vinyl in there.
Oh, really?
What?
Yeah.
Are you serious? Whoa.
It's a good thing I have it, Ryan.
I will guide you to it.
Fuck.
Yeah.
Guiding us.
Yeah,
to the vinyl.
Where do you go from there?
Well, no, I'm just proud that I wrote it down.
Lots of places.
Oh, so you wrote it down.
I wrote down a few titles because I thought we were going to like defend things.
I figure
things.
At the end we'll throw out some extras. So I have a few. Yeah.
I've got to say, look, we also watched Leatherface together one time, and we watched an unrated. How was that? Like, how were you watching some of those effects? Was it extra feature?
No, the DVD release of it included both a unrated cut and an R-rated cut, although... I think the unrated is as complete as it can be, although director Jeff Burr will still tell you there's tons missing.
Yeah. The unrated, I think the difference is the little girl's involvement in the violence. Because she pulls the... Yeah,
but it's,
yeah,
because there's a part all, where somebody like, does this and it just cuts. And then there's one where it goes... And the blood everywhere.
No, it's all subtle. Like, every kill sequence is much more graphic in the unrated.
I mean, we were talking about this on the Jason panel today. You just can't censor horror and expect that the movie's going to come out okay. Because you are changing the actual context of the stuff. That is a viscera is a part of this genre, and it's an important part. It's not just that we shortened a few scenes. No, you've actually killed the point of the creation. And I felt that in Jason Goes to Hell. When I started in the theaters, it kind of pissed me off, but I remember thinking, it's kind of a fun concept. Watching it with you, I really thought it was a fun movie, and I thought the actual kill scenes were astounding, and it really pisses me off when people fuck with horror. I'm sorry. Especially MPA. Like, there should be censorship anyway.
Get mad.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, we talked about the same thing in the brain damage panel.
I'm so mad I'm going to talk about Frighteners now.
Yeah!
That's how mad I am.
Frighteners.
Yeah.
Is that underrated?
In New Zealand, a young man was born... called Peter Jackson.
Oh, this is why.
What happened to him?
Who would go on to make, I don't know, some shitty Hobbit movie. but once upon a time, this guy had an incredible sense of humor with his first three films, I think, are all brilliant and subversive and funny. I was going to do something really serious at the end of this and talk about The Kingdom, because I think Kingdom's one of the greatest things ever. And so because we have our friend Mr. Udo in the house today, you should watch The Kingdom. It's a brilliant, but it is a it's a series, multiple episodes.
I wonder where you could watch it.
Oh, you can watch on Shudder?
Can you watch that on Shudder?
Boom. You can, Udo here, when you meet Udo here, imagining him being birthed as a 45-year-old man through a woman. It is the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. Yes, that's a scene in that movie.
The Kingdom is incredible.
The Kingdom is Lars von Trier.
Episodes of Von Trier.
It's masterful.
Unfiltered.
Now, they made an American version of Kingdom Hospital, which
does not have Udo Kier.
Yeah, it does not. No. It needs some Udo Kier. No. But the original is just, it's
anyway.
Spellbinding.
So anyway,
are we talking about Kingdom or are we talking about Frighteners?
I'm not talking about
Frighteners.
Okay.
I got lost.
And you looked at me just when I said Frighteners with absolute disgust. So tell me what's the problem.
No, he's with you.
I'm with you.
I just don't like it.
No, but what didn't
How
you like
not
about
like Frighteners?
It's just not my shit, man. Yeah.
I thought we were one, like a broken heart, Laura Palmer's heart that was spread across different places.
It's, you know, I'm Donna, you're Laura, we dance in the fields. It's just not my thing.
Okay. No, I will say that Frighteners, now watching it, because I watched it just a couple months ago, it feels way more CG'd than it did
when it first came.
It really pulled me out, like where the faces are coming out of the walls. When I was like in high school watching it, I was like, oh my God, this is so like mind-blowing.
You're right, I hate that movie.
Scary.
Let's pick another one. No, I'm not going to do that. Jeffrey Combs is so fun.
Yes.
And I love Jeff Combs. Of all the people I've met in LA, we've met all these people that we've been doing interviews of and so forth forever. Jeff Combs is like, I think he's one of the coolest guys, but he's also a great actor. If you ever get a chance to see him play Edgar Allan Poe, it will literally blow your mind. You'll
he
be
gave
like,
my
you didn't think he could do that.
To the show.
Yeah, he's no.
Like,
he's,
he invited me and I said, oh, I can't come. My parents
he's
are in town. So he gave them tickets too.
Top notch actor who hasn't really landed many roles that would tell you he's that good an actor. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that. But I thought The Frighteners Hustle was one of the few where he's playing a crazy FBI agent. For those who don't know, Michael J. Fox basically can see ghosts, and it's caused him problems with it in his own relationships, and they kind of fuck with him, and it's a comedy. I mean, to me, it seems like it would be a Rob favorite when you're young, to me. But
I loved it because it's to me, it's in that same vein as, like, you know, kind of like Ghostbusters-ish.
Yeah. No, it's in that vein.
But I like that it gets really dark. It's very lighthearted and kind of like, oh, this is kind of like a kid horror movie. But then that last third act when, like, death himself comes down. Not really, but it's supposed to be death.
Well, because they correspond with
something. It's about serial killers trying to get this number. Like, they want to reach this particular number.
Yeah, there's a serial killer who's alive, one who's dead, and they're both trying
The other great performance is another woman who is here. Dee Wallace Stone is phenomenal in this. Yeah. I think she was totally... I don't think people were paying attention to how good she was in this. Totally hiding. Jake Busey's really good, but I think she's particularly strong in it. And they are trying to kill... What is the number they're trying to get to?
They hit a goal and now they're just trying to outdo themselves.
And each person gets the victim's number is carved into their head. I don't know. I feel this film was number one that year, because this was when in New Zealand we didn't have any director, especially in genre, breaking through. And so everyone paid a lot of attention to what Peter Jackson was doing. And I remember when this film came out, the stat was, oh, it's number one in Brazil. Cool. But because it had tanked in America, but it had done pretty well in other places, and it still gave him enough leverage to get another film made. And that's the important part.
Now, what happened? Because the script was originally created as a Tales from the Crypt script, right?
There was, they were going to develop it as originally. A Tales from the Crypt Presents. Yeah.
And then it kind of spun off on its own.
Yeah, I think the producers who were involved were also part of the Tales from the Crypt family. And then when that just didn't happen, they just took it somewhere else. Yeah.
Well, there's a pretty lengthy gap between Frighteners and Lord of the Rings, I think was the next thing he did. Because he had a really tough time on it. And
big pitch.
And I remember, I don't know, I assume it's on the Blu-ray, but I remember my friend had the Laserdisc of it when it came out and had this very lengthy...
It was a four-disc set.
Yeah, it's this documentary about all that stuff that you said was CG. Like, they built it all, practically, and none of it worked. Like, at all. It's all in the documentary about it. So, like, they had no choice but to figure out other methods to do. And I think, I mean, that kind of explains Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit movies. Like, it's just he's become so reliant on that because it's kind of surefire way to work. But, I also love Michael J. Fox.
Yeah,
I
always thought it's the last big role we got from him, really.
Yeah, and I think he's great in it.
Yeah,
the script, if you look at the script, it kind of meanders, but it's incredibly, it's not a tight movie because it rambles, but... Everything has connective tissue. Everything is tied together. Everything ties up at the end, and that's what I remember really appreciating about it. And let's not forget, not between Frighteners and Lord of the Rings, there was not a gap because he did Heavenly Creatures.
Yes.
Oh, you're right.
Yes.
And Heavenly Creatures is a masterpiece with Kate Winslet and Melanie Linsky.
And he was actually
Linsky.
Nominated for an Oscar for that. And that definitely comes under horror. It's true crime. You know, it's a true story. And
That's my shit.
No, you love that one. Two girls living literally in a dream world that they've created for themselves, and when something else forces to threaten to pull them apart, they eliminate the problem.
Well, and you look at that movie, and after Frighteners, it forced them to go back and do something that is... deeply emotional and personal. And
the weird thing is,
creative.
I thought that was before Frighteners. No. I thought that got him Frighteners.
No.
Yeah.
Are you sure? Because in my mind, that was his, like, the thing that plateaued him and got him the gig.
No, I thought that the Frighteners script was floating around before Heavenly Creatures.
Heavenly Creatures before Frighteners?
Yeah.
No shit.
Yeah, I guess we should listen to whoever's from New Zealand.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, moving on.
Your stats on what is a big box office movie.
Hey, The Relic was huge.
Relic's huge.
Number one in Brazil.
Frighteners, what a big movie.
Remember, Elric tried to convince us at one time that Society was huge because it was
huge
in New Zealand.
Society was big. It would be next to Reanimator, so I thought it was equally big. Sorry.
Yeah, we were like, that was the smaller release here, dude. My next one, I actually wrote down two films from the same director, and I've been sitting here going back and forth which one to go over. So the director, this one? I figured you'd yell at me
and say
wasn't horror.
Do both. They're
okay,
both cool.
So my director is Alex de la Iglesia, and I probably said his name wrong. So I love this guy. Like, most of what he's done, I absolutely love. Like, even his weird, like, math one with Elijah Wood that everybody's like, I don't know about that.
I never saw that.
I fucking love that film.
Oxford Murders,
yeah.
I love it. But most recently, the one that people know is Witching and Bitching. Is his.
Yes.
But he had two films during the 90s that I absolutely love. So I will do both and quickly go over them. So the first one has never been released to DVD here in the States. And it is like criminal that this has never happened. And that's Day of the Beast. And
great movie.
One of the best and funniest horror comedies you will ever see. It is about a priest who knows that Satan is coming, the Antichrist is coming, and he knows that in order to get as close as possible so that he can kill the Antichrist, he has to commit as many sins as he can to get close to the Antichrist. So the movie opens with him dropping this giant fucking crucifix on a nun and then literally just going through the streets, pushing people over, pushing them into garbage cans. He just walks up and punches somebody and he's just trying to sin as much as possible. And while he's doing all this, he hears this music playing and sees all these pentagrams in this window, and it's a record shop. And he meanders his way in and is talking to this like crazy metalhead who runs the record shop. And it's like, he asks him, because he's very like not familiar with this world. And he goes like, do you know how to get close to Satan? And so the guy hands him all these satanic records. And so the priest is like, dude, this guy must know Satan. So then you've got a priest and a metalhead who are now teaming up against the Antichrist. But not being done there, they keep seeing ads. You see him from the beginning for this kind of Chris Angel-esque magician who's like, you know, I'm the real deal. I have the spirit. I can make you disappear. And so then they're both like, hey, this guy apparently has like magical powers. Let's get him. And so it becomes a Chris Angel-esque magician, a metalhead who runs a record shop, and a priest team up to fight Satan on New Year's Eve.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. It's a great movie, yeah. And it is one of my favorite films of all time, 1995. Has never been released to DVD in the U.S.
Yeah, just like I bought my copy in Mexico City.
Wow, I have it on VHS. And yeah,
I still have Michael Gingold's DVD copy.
Mike was our old managing editor at Fangoria, and he now writes for like everybody.
And I'm almost surprised he's never been like, "Do you still have that?"
So if you have not seen Day of the Beast, I cannot recommend it enough. The other one from Alex de la Iglesia that I'll go over is from 1997. So just 2 years after Day of the Beast was made in Spain. Perdita. I'm doing Perdita. So Day of the Beast was made in Spain. And after everybody saw this and was like, oh, this guy's really got something. This is a great horror film. Somebody said, let's let him make a big American movie, a big American horror movie. And so he decided to do Perdita Durango. And some people will know the idea of Perdita Durango because in David Lynch's Wild at Heart, the character Perdita Durango comes up briefly. She's played by Isabella Rossellini. And it's from the novel Luna.
Barry Gifford, who co-wrote Lost Highway as well.
Yeah, Luna and Sailor. Mm-hmm. And so Perdita Durango was this character. She'd been around for a while. If you actually read the Barry Gifford novel, she plays a much larger role. So Alex came over and said, you know what? For my first big American film, I want to tell the story of Perdita Durango. Supposed to be a huge film, so he cast Rosie Perez, who was like fresh off Oscars at the time.
White Man Can't Jump.
Yeah, White Man Can't Jump. Like, she was hot at the time. And the movie is about her, and she's dressed up in this like Tura Santana Faster Pussycat garb, and she's hanging out at the border between U.S. and Mexico, and she meets Javier Bardem.
In his first real American role. He'd been in Almodovar films, but this was like an explosion of talent that no one was ready for.
And he plays a drug dealer, gangster, voodoo priest, and his voodoo was all done with Screamin' Jay Hawkins, who plays a role in the movie, although he later claimed he didn't remember shooting most of it. And then, so the whole thing is supposed to be about them pulling off this heist. And this is where it starts to get weird and uncomfortable, and part of the reason that it's never been released here. They then kidnap two teens who they like repeatedly rape throughout much of the movie. They also hijacked a truck full of human fetuses, which are being used to make makeup. And the whole movie just goes off the rails there. But at the same time, it's a comedy because every so often, Javier is a big fan of Herb Alpert. So occasionally, like, Mexican Flea or Spanish Flea will come on the radio and he'll start dancing. And it's just bizarre because there's just so much tonally going on with this. So it's graphic. It's bizarre. There's these weird voodoo scenes in the middle. There are these teens that are being held hostage. It's uncomfortable but funny. And they did a very brief release. It did get a very small DVD release here under the name Dance with the Devil. And nobody saw it. And so it never got anything else. But
Alex de la Iglesia's movies are like all messy. Mm-hmm. And like it transcends the idea of like whether it works or not. Because they're all such like singular voices. He's the best.
Yeah. So it's one of those directors that I just feel like more people need to look at some of his work. And yeah, even
his dark like crime, like Commonwealth and Perfect Crime are great.
Or he did on The Baby's Room.
Which is part of Six Films to Keep You Awake. Yeah, it's terrifying.
And it's like a straight horror where it's literally about a man and his wife who move into this house and they start seeing ghostly images on the baby monitor.
It's on Shudder.
And it's on Shudder. Oh, that movie scared the crap out of me the first time I saw it. It's like genuinely terrifying.
It's really terrifying.
Doesn't go quite as off the rails as a lot of his other films do, but still really tight.
And this would be a good double with No Country for Old Men, because Javier is really scary in No Country for Old Men that everyone's seen.
He's
but
scary
in Perdita, he's way more terrifying. It's a less predictable character in a sense. And, you know, it's hard to believe her, but between all the rape and fetuses, it's actually pretty funny.
It is. It's weird to say that this movie is somehow funny. And, I mean, because it's appalling at the same time. It's generally like you're watching it going, oh, my God, I can't believe they just did that. It's like if somebody made Last House on the Left as a comedy. It somehow works.
And there's a movie that I know Ryan has seen as well, and I want to compare it to early Alex de la Iglesia. I don't know how many of you regularly go to film festivals, but it's on the festival circuit. If you hear of a movie called Night of the Virgin,
Night of the Virgin.
It's from Spain. It is insane.
It's bonkers.
It is
nuts.
The sort of insane that you're hoping for. The sort of insane that like everyone in this room that we all look for, that we all go, I haven't seen something this gonzo, this bloody, this weird, this gnarly.
What's it called again?
Night of the Virgin.
It's basically the...
And it works. Like, yeah. It is all of those things with good production value and just shit you have never seen before.
I'm sure you've all seen Devil's Backbone. Mm-hmm. So there was a character in it named Owl, I think his name was. He had like the kind of big spectacles or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he's all grown up now. And in the film, he plays a virgin who goes to a nightclub on New Year's Eve and hopes to score, and he finds an older woman who takes him back home, but she's got other plans for him. And her boyfriend shows up. And it's 2 hours of just pure just insanity.
Yeah.
It's insane. And the third act just
it's
goes
sort of like
real gross out gags. My qualm with it is it's 2 hours. So, like, you easily could shave 30 minutes from it and have a really lean, insane film. But once it gets out there, we'll keep you looped in as to when it comes to the U.S.
Keep it on your mind.
Or when Shudder gets it.
Please keep it on your mind.
Yeah.
So my final selection, yes, honey, I want to add Wishmaster to this. but I just waxed poetic about Wishmaster 3 episodes ago because I bought the 4-disc box set and I'm still getting through 4. but Wishmaster is pretty dope. I want to add a movie that everybody knows about, but I feel is totally unloved, and that's 1999 Stir of Echoes.
1999. Yeah. I'm going to prove that in a moment.
It's my final pick. Yeah.
Stir of Echoes.
Oh,
you know,
Rob, you picked it too?
Yeah, I've been batting around what I wanted it to be, but I thought about it. I was like, that would be my final
Stir of Echoes. Yeah, it came out like months after The Sixth Sense came out, and I think everybody still had their M. Night Shyamalan glasses on, where they were like, it's the most amazing movie. But David Koepp's quiet little ghost story adapted from a Richard Matheson novel, it just works. It is
very scary.
Yeah. It's a story that is incredibly familiar now. I mean, it's just like, guy can see a ghost. The ghost is trying to tell him to do something. He's following it. His family doesn't know what's going on. But when it came out in 99, it was a supernatural thriller that really worked. And Kevin Bacon plays a working class dad in Chicago who moves into a home and, you know, he starts to see these images of a teenage girl who had been killed. And he, you know, he just kind of goes off on this mission to figure out why she was killed. And the mystery lies within the very walls and foundation of his house. So, you know, at first he's like tearing down the walls. And then he's like, nope, it's not in the walls. It's in the basement. And starts just drilling into the basement foundation. But, you know, and there's a little bit of like a connection to his son who also has abilities. And they played that up in the trailers, and I think that's what steered everybody away from it because they were like, oh, great, Sixth Sense 2. To me, you know, it just really worked on a writing level and a performance level. You know, I've never seen a working-class dad be portrayed in such a very natural way as it did in Kevin Bacon's character. He did a really, really great job of it. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just a dude that just, like, cuts wire. He's the guy hanging off, you know, like getting your phones installed and stuff. But, you know, David Koepp, at the time, he was a writer who was known for big blockbuster movies. He wrote The Lost World. He was involved in
Mission Impossible.
Mission Impossible.
Brian De Palma masterpiece.
Yeah.
I love that movie. I'm not joking.
I do too. No, I do too.
I just want to be clear.
No, and that's a very, I mean, like, if you look at Mission Impossible and the script, it's a very sophisticated movie. It's fucking like, woo. But Kep was known for the big blockbuster stuff. So it was great to just see him turn around and do something a little more insular, scary, classical. It's well shot. Who's the actress? New York actress, the one who hypnotizes him.
I know. She's on
Ileana Douglas. Yeah. Ileana Douglas. Thank you.
I remember those hypnotism scenes being so just tense because it's so smart. Like, instead of the ghost just like being like, I'm here, like instead of it just whispering messages.
There's a moment where she grabs him and she grabs his skin. She grabs his arm and his entire arm goes pale and you see these veins creeping up his arm because she's literally pulling him into her realm.
But I remember the theater scenes because when he's hypnotized,
he
will wake up in a massive, grandiose theater by himself, and then the whole thing of how he would realize
the messages.
Floating
towards the screen.
He would be floating towards the screen and what was on the screen would be blurry and it would slowly come into focus as a word. Yeah. And it was always like, oh my God, what is it? What is it? And there was like a scare every time. But it was so well done.
It's really well thought out. Really, really well thought out. If you guys have never seen a film called The Trigger Effect, mm-hmm. David Koepp did that a couple years prior. It's really not necessarily a successful movie in terms of the themes it's trying to get across, but it's an interesting film. I think Bill Pullman is in it. But check that out. And if you haven't seen Stir of Echoes, check that out as well.
Definitely.
Yeah, that was my final pick, mainly because it's so funny because I saw a test screening of it a few months before Sixth Sense. And knew nothing about it other than, hey, it's called Stir of Echoes, it stars Kevin Bacon. I remember seeing it, I was like, this movie's going to be fucking huge. Like, that's all I kept thinking. I was like, this is a great little, like, commercial horror movie that's going to play to everybody. And then The Sixth Sense just completely changed
it. Devastated it.
And I remember thinking, oh, man.
Yeah.
So I think it's that underrated gem from that era that people should discover now.
And I know, and I haven't seen The Sixth Sense since its opening night, and I think that's a testament to my connection to the film. Mm-hmm. But I've seen Stir of Echoes many, many times. I don't know what it is. I almost say, Night is going to kill me for this, but I actually think Stir of Echoes is the stronger film.
There's a nice Blu-ray out of it.
I disagree with that.
All right.
Sam.
All right.
Final pick.
You know, I've been racking my mind this whole time, switching up answers. This one's for Elric.
All right.
It's a New Zealand film called The Ugly.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
1997, Scott Reynolds.
Yeah.
Such an interesting serial killer film that exists in a real weird spot. Did it ever come out here?
Yeah, it was a direct-to-video release.
It was a direct-to-video release here, 97. It's so interesting to watch now because it exists sort of in this world where it's ahead of its time and past its prime. It's sort of pulling from, like, the 90s noir serial killer thing that we had seen. But also, I swear to God, it is pre-Saw in a lot of ways. Like, the look of it, the texture, like, the green, like... Yeah. And it's just a cool, it's all based on this one interrogation of the serial killer, and he's sort of messing with the interrogator.
I've seen this.
Yes. And, you know, pulling visions and maybe telling her the truth and maybe not. And it's grisly and it's weird. And it's a film that is really worth discovering. What was your memory of it? Was it a big hit? Was it a hit? Was it a real hit or an Elric hit?
Really?
It was a New Zealand hit.
Yeah.
We made three films that year. I don't know. What do you want? The other two are animated. Fuck it. I don't know. No, but Paolo Rotunda, the actor in the lead role, is incredible. And he's actually become a director in New Zealand now. Really nice guy. The director, Scott Reynolds, made about three other films. And this is the thing when you deal with studios. He made a film.
He made a film after that got mangled.
A very
mangled.
Interesting film called Heaven.
Yeah.
But it didn't really get mangled. What happened is it got to Miramax. And
that's what I mean.
And it has a transsexual lead character in it that apparently pissed off Weinstein, Harvey Weinstein, so much that he said it will be shelved and never seen. Mm-hmm. And so this was a film, and I saw it, and I was like, oh, this is a fucking good movie.
Heaven could is have been awesome. The guy's, I think there's a DVD of Heaven.
Yeah, it could have been his breakthrough into making bigger American films, but instead, because one guy just was like, yeah, I don't like it, I'm putting it on a shelf. And so this is, there's different levels of censorship. There's MPAA censorship, but then there's like Perdita Durango and the movie we're talking about now, where a studio goes, you know what, we don't like how it turned out, we're not even going to do anything to it, because it costs more to promote it, and they just stick it on a shelf. That's criminal shit to me. Because some artists have gotten together and they've made something. They've created something for people to see. I mean, it's criminal in, as a film lover, is what I mean. Mr. Ryan is laughing at my... but, you know, no, I really do think. So I think he's got a talent. He's a talented visual director. He made a film afterwards. I can't remember. The Sheep... it's a thriller in Australia. And it was pretty solid. But, you know, that hurts your career when
it does.
Studios
and
The
Ugly is like a, it's such a cool movie. Like, it's a cool serial killer, but not straight crime, not
and
grit.
And he'd like it because of the mother's side.
Well, no, like,
a lot of
psycho
kind of.
I love this movie. Yeah. And what I remember about it, what stands out is I was reading about it in the pages of Fangoria, and it was the only horror movie that era that had black blood. The blood wasn't red. It was just such a strange, like, stark visual. That I was like, oh, I'd never seen black blood before, because the killer usually slices people's throats, and so he has visions of his victims, and they all have like this.
Oh,
black,
that's the other thing. It's like ahead of its time with like that sort of ghostly vision of like the black eye and things like that. But it works there.
Yeah. So I remember that sticking out to me, seeing that image of just a bunch of ghosts with like black blood, and I'm like, well, I need to see that movie. It's a super cool little movie. I think there's a DVD of it.
There is. Okay, good. It's absolutely worth seeking out. I only saw it very recently, probably in the last 2 years, because of Mitch Davis, who's the director of the Fantasia International Film Festival in Montreal. If you're ever thinking, like, I want to go to Montreal, and what's a reason to go to Fantasia and see Montreal.
Awesome.
Montreal's a great city, but, like, here's the thing to do. Fantasia's one of the great genre festivals.
It runs for 2 full weeks.
Yeah, it's, like, crazy long. It's full of amazing
horror
films and fantasy films and science fiction films and thrillers and all that stuff. It's a really cool festival, and Mitch is... one of the people I look up to is like who to find movies from. And Mitch was speaking about The Ugly very recently within the last 2 years. And that's how I finally came around to it.
That's why we love Mitch.
Yeah, he's the man. Mitch rules. He's one of the most enthusiastic people I've ever met in my life.
So that's the 90s.
Well,
we got Rob.
No,
Rob, you want to cap off with another
one?
No, because I was thinking Frighteners, and you picked it, and then I was thinking Surf Echoes, and were thinking of Urban Legend, but the honest truth, Sam, is I like Urban Legend 2 better.
Urban Legend 2.
Well, take Urban Legend 2 out of context, and it works.
Wow. You know what? It totally does. So thanks, Ryan.
Well, I'm going to now read off 1999, because as we were researching this, I just went through each year, and I was like, oh, okay, well, that came out in 1996. And I was
what also made your list?
The other ones that I didn't discuss, Baby's Blood.
I had Baby Blood on my original list. It's so good.
Epic. And especially, that's a cool movie. I would never endorse seeing the American dubbed version, except in this case, because Gary Oldman. Baby Blood, it's singular, is about a circus performer who gets pregnant, but her husband's really abusive, so she runs away, but then she realizes that what she is pregnant with is a parasitic alien that she has to feed blood to. But it talks to her.
Yeah, and they develop this like buddy relationship.
Yeah, she's like, yeah, I want to help you because you're kind of cool. And it like starts to learn about humanity through her, but she has to kill people to keep it alive.
Yeah,
and it's
a better version of the Prevenge.
I was going to say, it sounds like Prevenge.
I know, sorry. Hey. Shutter title. No,
but the best part about it, and again, it's awesome in the French subtitled version, but the parasite is very curious about humanity, and it's very poetic, and it talks to her, and it philosophizes with her. And in the American one, the parasite is played by Gary Oldman. And that is worth watching the dub.
Yeah,
right,
and the
there.
Opening is on. I watched the opening weirdly a lot. It's just like this 2-minute scene, and it's just like negative space and weird colors and like waves crashing,
the
and
ocean,
the parasite
cosmos,
just talking.
And yeah,
he's just like, and I mean, like,
she has
I
that great gap between her teeth.
Yeah,
I always
oh
that.
Yeah.
It's just a weird
thing. We went from the opening scene to like, man, what a babe with
yeah,
the
yeah, what a
gap.
Babe with the pregnant and the blood and
gap in her teeth. Anthony Hitchcock's babe eyebrows.
I also wrote down another highly underrated serial killer film, which I've talked about on the show before, Lighthouse, aka Dead of
Lighthouse
Night.
Is very cool.
I love that one. 1996.
Snaps over there.
I got snaps. Hell yeah.
The 90s snaps.
Yeah. So 1996, Lighthouse or Dead of Night. It is about a prison ship that is transporting some prisoners, one of whom is a very violent serial killer known as a headhunter. The prison ship crashes onto some rocks, and everybody who was aboard the ship, the guards, the nurse, the other prisoners, all have to take refuge on this lighthouse island where there's two lighthouse keepers. And so all of these survivors wash up, and then they realize, holy crap, the headhunter's with us. And so he starts picking off people on the island. And so like the guards and the prisoners have to kind of team up to try to fight him. And it's really awesome.
It's fun.
Because you got the ocean and the only light is the lighthouse. And it's really good.
All right, guys, thank you so much for coming out.
Yes,
for live episode.
And you guys rule.
Thank you for tuning in to episode number 50 of Shockwaves. On behalf of the whole Shockwaves crew, we just wanted to take a minute to thank the Texas Frightmare Weekend for having us. Thank you, Lloyd Cryer. Thank you, Bradley Harding. Thanks to the whole staff and crew there for doing such an excellent job and making sure we had a great weekend. Also, special thanks to our sponsor, Shudder, and in particular, Sam Zimmerman, for joining us for the live podcast. And since this is episode 50, I wanted to give you guys a little something special. We haven't brought this up since the very beginning, but occasionally we get asked about the opening theme music to Shockwaves. That was composed by Blumhouse.com editor Gregory Burkhart under the moniker of Corvo. And as a special added bonus, we're going to play the entire track for you. It's actually a 6-minute track titled, hopefully I'll get this right, Fantomotique. I think I said that correctly. But anyway, what better way to close out episode 50 than when with giving you the full version of this Corvo song. Thanks for your support.
were watching a movie and then suddenly were acting in it.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Shudder, the premium streaming video service devoted to horror, thrillers, and suspense. Backed by AMC Networks, Shudder has a growing and dynamic selection of thrilling premieres, originals, and exclusives, including pregnancy horror comedy Prevenge, the Ring vs. the Grudge franchise mashup Sadako vs. Kayako, and We Are the Flesh. This week's Shudder highlight is Jordskatt, a 10-episode folk horror series declared by Dread Central the kind of mystery show you wish were made more often. When Eva, a policewoman, returns to her hometown several years after her daughter's disappearance, she quickly begins investigating a new wave of vanishing children. As her search draws her deep into the forest, she realizes there are supernatural secrets in the town, and if she exposes them, it could make someone or something very angry. Stream the series called A Borgian and Stranger Things Mashup by the Toronto Star now exclusively on Shudder. Shudder is available for the web, iOS, Android, Chromecast, Apple TV, and Roku for $4.99 a month or $49.99 with an annual membership. But Shockwaves listeners get a free month by entering the promo code SHOCK at checkout. Go to Shudder.com today and find the best collection of horror available to stream anywhere.